And the incubator, supposedly you go to Babson to build companies, the incubator was in the basement in the back of the building with no windows. I said, I get it. I know you're right, but you're the wrong professor for an international MBA school. Hmm. And that's when the dean just said, Daniel, please leave the room. So I left the room. But just to give you an idea of the size of the countries, Mexico Pemex, the oil company of Mexico, had more revenue than the GDP of Chile, Argentina, and Uruguay combined.
Wow.
You as an entrepreneur, you know everything that is happening in the company. And you know that you have some things that are not right or not done well, or you have your certain hole or your certain risks. And when you focus on that, you have an impostor syndrome.
Welcome to The Show Goes On. This is a podcast about people who keep the businesses running, no matter the challenges. My name is Amir Narani, and today I'm joined by an incredible guest, Daniel Marcos. Daniel, huge, huge fan of the Growth Institute and the Scaling Up methodology. Thank you so much for being here today. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. Thanks. Thanks for the invitation.
Of course, of course. So when people ask you what you do, how do you usually answer?
I help CEOs be better CEOs. That's overall what I do. We have Growth Institute that we work with the management team, but we really help you build a CEO system. So let me walk you through this. You go to a company and ask, hey, show me your systems. And they show you their customer support system and production system and accounting and all that. And I say, now show me your CEO system. And I say, what do you mean? No, like, how do you take decisions as CEO? And everyone tells you what they do, but it's completely random and different. And no one has like a set rules or tools to be better CEO. So what we do at the Growth Institute is we help you build a CEO system around scaling up mostly, and really help you have discipline on the decisions that you take, and then have discipline on the execution of those decisions. And it helps you become a better CEO just because you have a system and a process of how you take decisions, how do you delegate the decisions, how you track all of that. And it's just, first, it's easier for you as a CEO. Mm-hmm. You gain back many, many hours and a lot of your time. You reduce the drama and you're a better CEO. You take better decisions. So that's exactly what we do.
Yeah, for sure. I could totally see that. I feel like when a lot of entrepreneurs are first starting out, you're kind of just winging it.
Yes.
You're like, hey, hopefully this works. And you're just flinging stuff against the wall.
No one teaches you how to be a CEO. They tell you about, you have to take this leadership book and this process book and this systems book or whatever. But no one really teaches you what is your role as a CEO. Mm-hmm. And how to put all the tools together. One thing that people said, well, I read this book, or I took this course. And now, but how do you put them together? And how do you really build a system that makes sense? And by the way, we have systems and certifications for everything in our business, mm-hmm. except for being a CEO.
Very true.
Because we believe we're great. No, I need a certification for my team. I need them to have whatever certification or training or whatever. And when it comes to a CEO, no, doesn't matter.
Very true. And I think you had talked about this in your story where you expect to probably learn these things when you're getting an MBA. And the surprise is that you really don't learn a lot of the stuff when you're getting an MBA, right?
I think the MBA was great for critical thinking. I saw case studies and all these things, but no tools on how to run my company and no idea what it was to be a CEO. And this is something that I went to Babson, supposedly the number one entrepreneurial school in the world. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good school and I learned a lot. My experience going through Babson was amazing. But more as I grew up in Mexico, I was born in Mexico. So come to the U.S. and go to a U.S. college and all that was a great experience. I got there married. 1 year in Boston with my wife was amazing. But I learned very little tools on how to scale my business. But it gave me a seal or a certification to say, hey, you have an MBA in one of the best business schools in the U.S. And then when you go and do business somewhere and someone knows that you're a graduate from that top school or a good school, then it gives certain status. So as an example, Vern, when we started doing business, he introduced me. Yeah, my friend and my partner, Daniel Marcos, went to Babson. And one day I said, Vern, do you really care that I went to Babson? And the guy said, not at all. But whenever I'm introducing you to someone, when I tell them you went to Babson, they at least assume you understand certain rules for business in the US.
Yeah.
So for me, it was telling them you went to Babson is the easiest phrase that I could give for someone to gain trust and knows certain things about you, right? So I think that was great for me coming to the US. But I was in school, and one day I realized whenever you enter the building of the MBA, the first office on the right is the placement office. So when a company goes to hire students to Babson, that's the office, right? And the incubator, supposedly you go to Babson to build companies, the incubator was in the basement in the back of the building with no windows.
Oh, wow.
So I went to complain to the dean. So I went to the dean's office, I knocked the door and said, "Can I come in?" And the dean's like, "Who are you?" And I was like, "I'm one of your students." The guy's like, "Yeah, sure, come in." So I go in and said, "Hey, I have a question." And the guy said, "Yeah. Why you have the placement office in the beautiful office just in the entrance and the incubator in the basement with no windows?" And the guy said, "What do you mean?" And I was like, "Doesn't this supposed to be the most entrepreneurial MBA in the US or in the world?" And I was expecting the incubator was going to be an amazing place with everything you need to build an amazing company, right?
Yeah.
It's a basement, no windows, no nothing. It's like, yeah, you want to do your business? Okay, you go, right? There was no structure, there was no nothing, no curriculum, no nothing. And the guy said, "Well, you have to understand mindset or entrepreneurial, it's a mindset." And I was like, "No, like entrepreneurship is about building companies, right?" So it was a shock to see that. I fired a professor 2 months after going to my MBA, or I helped get a professor fired. He was demoted from MBA to undergrad. So it was
Really?
my first month in business school. And then I went to a dean and complained about the office. So I was not a very popular student because I went and complained a lot. But hey, I'm an entrepreneur. I see things and I just need to fix them or at least
Yeah,
raise the hand.
yeah.
There's something wrong here. So quickly, I went to Babson and I did a 1 year. And you have like a very aggressive summer that you do a full year in a summer and then you do the second year. I was in my 30s. I didn't want to do 2 years of MBA. So I asked to be accepted to the 1 year. And the first term, in the first month, you go through a legal class or a law class. And I was studying one day late at night, probably 10 p.m. in the building. And this past student from last year goes through the building and sees me. "Hey, Daniel, how are you?" We start talking. I said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm studying for law. I have my law exam tomorrow." And the guy said, "Don't study. You're going to have a C." I was like, "What?" And the guy said, "Yeah, don't worry. Every guy from Latin America gets a C."
Huh.
And I was like, "Excuse me?" And the guy said, "Yeah, so don't worry. Don't study. You're going to get a C." And I said, "No, I'm going to study. I want to have a good grade." I studied, went to the exam, got a C. So as soon as I get the C, I turn around to the other Hispanics and, "What do you got? And what do you got?" And everyone got a C. And
What?
I was like, "What? This makes no sense." So when the class ends, I go and get their test and just read it. And we were very different test. We all got a C. So I go and knock on the dean's office and say, "Dean, can I talk to you?" And the guy said, "Like, how can I help?" I said, "I think you have a problem." And I said, "What problem do I have?" And I was like, all the Latin guys got a C, and I tell them a story. And he was like, "No, that's not true." And I was like, "Go and get your research." And the guy said, "Okay, let me do my research. I'll call you back." I'm fine. So he calls me back next week and said, "Daniel, I did your research. You're right. So I want to have a meeting with you and the professor to have a conversation." And I'm like, "Please." So he puts me with the professor in front of a dean and said, "The professor said, well, you did not answer what I asked, so you have a C." And I was like, "Yeah, but you asked me for this legal opinion. I took 5 hours of law in the US. I have no idea of the legal system in the US. I wrote what I think I learned with you, but you're asking me to write something that it's just impossible for me to write. And all the Latin people from Latin America, we come from the same legal system or a very similar legal system. So we all write very similar, and you put a C to everyone." And the guy said, "No, that's not true." And I was like, "Get the data." So they get the data and from last year, and all the Latins got a C. So the guy said, "But you're wrong, but your test should have a C." And I was like, "Fine, I'm okay if you believe my test should have a C. But I have a problem that you're a professor teaching in a world-class international business school, and you do not understand that we have a completely different legal system, and in 5 hours you want us to write in your format of legal system. That makes no sense. So if you want to be a professor of an international top school, you should be able to understand that. And the guy said, "But I'm right." So he starts getting defensive and challenging the dean. I said, "But I'm right. And like what you wrote is wrong, and because of the law," he just gets all this jargon and all these legal terms. I said, "I get it. I know you're right, but you're the wrong professor for an international MBA school." And that's when the dean just said, "Daniel, please leave the room." So I left the room. And I was called the next day and said, "We send the professor to teach to the undergrads." And I said, "Thank you."
Wow.
So the guy knew his stuff.
Yeah.
But he, if you want to be a professor of a top international school and you want to attract international students, you have to be able to understand international law
Of
and just
course.
the perspective.
Right, that makes sense. There's different cultures, there's different ways of doing things and being able to adapt, especially if you're a professor of an international school.
So just it's a little bit of, I think, an entrepreneur sees a problem
Yeah,
and
that's
fix
exactly
it.
what I was thinking, is that you have a tendency to want to like push against the system and shake things up and make it for the better.
Yeah. And by the way, one of the places that I get the most surprised that entrepreneurs don't do this is when they sell their company. So you break the rules and figure out different things while you build your business. And by the time you sell your business, you just go to an investment banker and said, "Hey, investment banker, I want to sell my business." They value it and said, "Hey, in your industry, they pay you 6 times EBITDA or 10 times EBITDA or whatever. We're going to do this process." And you say, "Okay." You leave it to the hands of the managing director of the investment bank. And that's it. I think that's wrong. Like, that's your harvest. That's when you get the most money. By the way, that was one of the most important classes I took in Babson. The importance of understanding valuations and process of selling your company and all that. And it was Jeffrey Timmons, by the way, that already passed. He was the most famous Babson business professor. He's the one that really built Babson as a business top business school. He died 2004.
Oh, wow.
But he teaches a class that he was called Harvesting. And it's how to really, whenever you get to the end of your company, when's the right time to sell it and how to sell it right. And that was one of the probably the top lesson I learned in Babson. Of the full cycle of selling or building, scaling, and then selling a company.
Okay, well, that's a great segue. Talk to us about your first big exit that you had, and you had it pretty early on, like in your twenties.
I was very early. Yeah, I was
Yeah.
25. So
Wow.
I went to college in Mexico, industrial
Okay.
engineering. And everything that I was reading in industrial engineering was about Japan, just in time and Kaizen and all these methodologies. So I wanted to go and work in a factory in Japan. And by the way, this is interesting. I was looking into the salaries of recent grads in Mexico, and an engineer recent grad was making like $700 a month of salary. And I'm like, I cannot live with that. I was already working in a brokerage house. I work in the mornings, in a brokerage house doing stock trading, and then in the afternoon going to college. And I was already making more than that in the mornings, working half time. So I said, I cannot work in a factory here. And everything that I learned is from Japan. So I want to go to Japan and learn from a factory in Japan. So I started asking around, "Hey, who knows someone in Japan?" and blah, blah. And my father said, "Hey, I have an ex-colleague, someone that used to work for me, that now he's the consul general in Hong Kong." And I was like, "Is Hong Kong Japan?" Like, I had no idea. I really had no idea. And my dad said, like, "No, Hong Kong is part of China," and tells me a story about England and all that. I said, "He's there. Why don't you call him?" And they're like, "Yeah, give me his phone." So I called the guy and said, "Hey, I'm looking for a job in Japan. Do you have any contacts?" And the guy said, "Okay, give me a couple of days and I'll call you back." I said, "Okay, great." So 2 days later, I get an email, "Call me back." So I call the guy, and the guy says, "I already have a job for you. You need to start June 1st or something like that." And I was like, "What?" And the guy said, "Yeah, but," and I was like, "Great. What's it in Japan?" And the guy said, "No, it's going to be in Hong Kong. You're going to come and work for me. But now you're closer, and from here, I'm going to help you do a jump to Japan. Work for me 2 years, and in 2 years, I'll help you jump." I said, "Fine." So I moved to Hong Kong for 2 years.
Wow.
And that was my first job out of college. I was the financial attaché at the Mexican consulate in Hong Kong. And I was there in 1997, 1998. And that's exactly when Hong Kong became part of China again. For someone who doesn't understand, is The British lease Hong Kong, or it's a piece of island and some mountains from the Chinese for 99 years. And that lease ended June 30th, 2007. So I was hired in 2007 to help with the transition and the relationship of Mexico with China and all the process of the transition with Hong Kong.
Wow, that's incredible.
I was extremely lucky to get that job. So I worked there for 2 years, went to World Bank meetings. I was the guy hiring, holding the briefcase for the Minister of Finance of my country when
Oh,
he met
yeah.
with Alan Greenspan, as an example. So I was in the meeting with Alan Greenspan. I met the president of Malaysia, Mahathir. It was an amazing experience. But I was the guy carrying the passports and the bags.
Yeah.
But I got to meet a lot of people, and most
Still amazing.
importantly, I got to meet a lot of people of my country that was the head of finance and the minister of the economy and all the big guys in the country, in my country. So it was a good job. But when I got there, I was used to trade stocks. I've been trading stocks for 3 years for clients, and I couldn't see the price of the stock, Mexican stocks online. There was no one that published the stocks. So I had to wait until night on Hong Kong time, like 11 p.m., called my stockbroker in Mexico and said, "What's the price of Cemex or Telmex or Bimbo or whatever?" They told me the price, and then I said, "Okay, buy or sell it." It's crazy. So back then in Mexico, if you want to see the stock price, the only way is to watch the news of the 6 p.m. There was a trigger below just with all stock prices. You could wait to the newspaper the next morning, and every newspaper had one page with all the stocks open, close, all that. Or you could pay Reuters $3,500 a month to have a Reuters screen. And I said, that's dumb. So after a year and a half in Hong Kong, I resigned, moved to Mexico to build the first fintech company in Mexico. And here it's really important to note, there was no one venture capital or private equity fund in Mexico in 1997. It didn't
Wow.
exist. So if you want to make a technology company, there was no way to raise money because there was no venture capitals. There was no angel investors. There was no angel investor associations, no venture capitals, no nothing.
That's insane. That's only like 25, 26 years
25
ago.
years ago, 1997.
Yeah.
I opened the first angel fund in 1999. So that was the first angel fund back then. But 1997, when I started, there was nothing. So I raised like 200,000 from friends and family. I went to the government and said, "I want the stock quotes." They said, "Well, you have to go to the market." So I went to the market, and the market said, "We don't have that. All the technology, like today, you go to a company, everyone has APIs." Back then, there was no APIs. The APIs were built by the company that wants to get the data. So the stock market said, "Here are my computers. You connect to my computers and get the data." So there were two companies that had APIs: Reuters and Infocel. Infocel was a Mexican Reuters. So the only two people that had the data of the stock market outside of the market was these two companies. So I went to the Mexican company called Infocel and said, "Hey, sell me your data. I'm going to put it online for free." And the CEO said, "You're crazy, right?" I was like, "No, like that's what's going to happen." And the guy said, "I have a company like Reuters. I charge $1,500 per screen. I have like 10,000 screens in the world or in Mexico leased. And you want to get all my information that I sell for $1,500 a month and put it for free online?" And I was like, "Yeah." And the guy said, "That's never going to happen. That's the jewel of the crown." And I was very persistent. And after 6 months, I convinced him to allow me to have all the data, publish it for
Wow.
free with 20 minutes delay to public or publish stock quotes online of the Mexican market in 1998. And of course, we blew up really fast.
Yeah.
And he gave me an exclusivity that I was the only other person that could have it, or only other company in Mexico. So 6 months after this, my biggest competitor in the region was an Argentinian company that had raised already $8 million from Chase. And now they went to raise to New York, went to JP Morgan, said JP Morgan went to do a financing round. And JP Morgan said, "I'm not going to do a round for less than 50 million. So if you don't allow me to invest or raise you 50 million, I'm not going to invest." And the guy was in Argentina. So like, what am I going to do with 50 million? At that moment, he already purchased a brokerage house in Chile and one in Venezuela. But just to give you an idea of the size of the countries, Mexico Pemex, the oil company of Mexico, had more revenue than the GDP of Chile, Argentina, and Uruguay combined.
Wow.
So Mexico and Brazil are very big countries compared to the rest of Latin America. So this guy had brokerage house in three countries, but very, very small countries. And most importantly, the stock markets were non-existent. So he went to JP Morgan and said, "There's impossible for me to raise 50 million because I don't have money to deploy 50 million in my countries." And the guy said, "Well, if you don't open Mexico and Brazil, you don't have nothing. So go back to your country, open Mexico and Brazil, and then come back and we will give you 50 million." So he calls me and said, "Daniel, I need to open Mexico tomorrow. Do you want to be with me or against me?" And I was like, "You're going to raise 50 million? I raised 200,000." I said, "Okay, great. Let's put something together." So I flew to Argentina. He did the same with the biggest online brokerage house in Brazil. By the way, Brazil technologically is way more advanced than any other country in Latin America.
Really?
We were putting stock quotes online for the first time, and Brazil already traded like 8% of the market online. It's crazy how advanced the Brazilians are in technology.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that Brazil is so far ahead of everyone else.
So 10 years ago, just FYI, and I don't know today, 10 years ago, Google had three technology centers in the world: San Francisco, Brazil, and somewhere else. They had three. So Brazil is very advanced. For the cost of programmers, for the quality, it's really, really high. So Brazil is very advanced in a lot of technologicals compared to any other country. So Wences, the guy in Argentina, called the biggest guy in Brazil and said, "Hey, I'm going to do this. I'm buying Finanzas in Mexico. Join us." So we flew to Argentina. We made the agreement. Next week, we flew to JP Morgan and said, "Now we have five countries. Give us the money." And we raised $53 million back then. But hey, just to give an idea, $53 million in 2000 or 1999 when we raised it was like probably 400, 500 million today.
Wow.
The GDP of the world today is 107 or 110 trillion dollars. When we crossed the year 2000, we were 20 trillion. So the economy of the world was a fifth when
Yeah.
we crossed Y2K, the 2000s. So, and in today's valuations, it was crazy, the numbers today. But we value the company at 100 million, raised 53 million. And we start growing really, really aggressive. At the moment when we raised the money, we were less than 100 employees within the three companies. A year later, we were 1,200 employees in operation in nine countries. So we
Wow.
started scaling really, 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 really fast. And then one of our investors, Banco Santander. Banco Santander is the 13th biggest bank in the world, is the biggest bank in Spain. And they are extremely big in Latin America. They're mo in most of the countries. In Latin America, they're a top three bank and sometimes top one bank in Latin America. So this was their market. We were getting online very, very aggressive. And they said, "We need to buy you. We don't care the price. Just give me a price." So we said, "Hey, we're not for sale. We already have, we just raised the money. We had like 40 million in the bank still." So we said, "We're not for sale. We have 40 million in the bank." And Santander said, "I don't care the price. Call all your investors, whatever they're willing to sell. You give the same price to everyone else, and I want to buy you next month." So we call everyone, and the hardest one was Carlos Slim, who used to be the richest man in the world, Mexican guy. He invested 7.5 million, and his son didn't want to sell. So we said, "We're going to pay you five times what you put of money 5 months before, or 6 months before, and we're going to buy you out." And the guy said, "Fine, if you pay me five times, I'm out." So we had to value the company at 780 million because that was five times the valuation. And we paid everyone at that valuation. That would be like a 3 or 4 billion of today's world back then. And then we sold to Santander. Santander bought 76% of the company. The employees, we own 24%. And by the way, we sold and we signed with Santander 2 days before the peak of the Nasdaq. So we were extremely lucky. We had no
Before
idea.
what happened with the Nasdaq?
I don't know if you remember, there was a peak of the Nasdaq. There was what they call the internet bubble in the 2000s.
Oh, okay. Oh, before the peak of the Nasdaq. Okay.
Remember, the Nasdaq fell like 70%
Yeah.
in April 2000. We
Oh my
sold
God.
2 days before the Nasdaq started peaking 70%.
Wow. Incredible timing then.
Incredible time. And
Wow.
Santander, part of the agreement, invested like 250 million more. Sumi had like 250 million in the bank. The stock market was getting destroyed. Every other competitor of us was getting destroyed. And we were on top of the world. We just sold to Santander and got 250 million in the bank. So it was a lot of fun. We opened a lot of banks and brokerage houses in Latin America. And I had a contract for 2 years. And after 2 years, I left.
This
But
is.
so I started at 25. Wences and all, Patagon happened at 26, 27. Santander. So I worked for Santander 2 years. So I left a week before my 29th birthday or my 30th birthday. So by 30, I already built a company, 1,200 employees, and sold it there. So just the learning behind it. Financially, it was not a good deal for me. I got decent money for my 20s. But what I learned and the experience of doing what we did, and that's one of the things that I'm most thankful to Wenceslao. He gave me a lot of responsibility really, really fast. And he was very open of everything that was happening in the company. So the learning and the negotiations with JP Morgan and things were amazing, at a very, very young age.
You said something very interesting. When you were running that company, you had hired a lot of people who had already gotten their MBAs and they were older than you, and you had felt like, hey, maybe these guys are smarter than me. It reminded me of like imposter syndrome. So can you talk a little bit about that?
So every entrepreneur has imposter syndrome every day. Not just me when I was having MBAs. I coach CEOs, and they're doing amazing, and they still have imposter syndrome. So as an example, I coach a CEO. He's 32 years old today. He does around 250 million a year in revenue. He's brilliant. And the guy feels imposter syndrome. They're like, oh, come on, like, you can't feel that. You know what I mean? And the guy, like, he has these doubts, and we have these conversations that those doors, we all feel it. So what you as an entrepreneur, you know everything that is happening in the company. And you know that you have some things that are not right or not done well, or you have your certain hole or your certain risks. And when you focus on that, you have an imposter syndrome. It's like, well, my company shouldn't be as big as it is or valued as much as it's valued. If they knew what I have here, like you will not be that excited about.
If you knew what I knew, you would not value it at this much.
So whenever you focus on those things, you get imposter syndrome. And we all know, we all have those bodies hidden in the company that we know we have to fix them, but at the moment they're wrong, or they're a weakness in the company. And by the way, I coach a lot of CEOs. I've been coaching CEOs for 15 years, and that's one of the biggest conversations that we have in the middle of the night or in the one-on-one calls. And I coach a lot of CEOs that have way bigger companies than me.
Yes, so tell us about the Growth Institute. I want to hear about that. How did that get started? How did that come about?
So after Patagon and Finances Way, we did great. Took a year off. I did a trip around the world of 16 months with my wife. We went to around 40 countries. And then we landed in Babson. And after Babson, I moved to the US to open a mortgage bank. So 2003, I opened a mortgage bank just to finance undocumented Hispanics. Back then, everyone was giving you loans. Even if you put the name of your dog in an application, you could get a loan. So it was the perfect time to finance a very big size of the market with no other options. So we started giving a lot of loans. We got a line of credit with Goldman Sachs and giving a lot of loans. But 2007, I was the subprime of the subprime. There was no one more subprime than me. So we got really, really, really hard hit then. So I lost all my money, got depressed, almost divorced. It was bad. I had 6 months, no sleep, waking up crying in the middle of the night. It was not a good moment in my life. And I got several calls. And one of them was Vern Harnish, Vern, the author of Scaling Up. And Vern used to be my mentor in my previous company. When I had certain issues, I called Vern and he coached me on how to overcome those issues. So Vern calls me and said, "Hey, how are you doing?" And I cried on the phone and I was a mess. And Vern said, "Hey, you are really, really good implementing Scaling Up and all this. Why don't you become a coach?" And I was like, "Vern, come on. Like, I don't trust myself to be an entrepreneur again. Do you think I'm going to be able to coach other CEOs?" And he was like, "Yeah, that's exactly right. Why? Because you've seen the really bigs and the bads, and you're going to be a great sounding board to CEOs." And I couldn't accept it at the moment. And then we continued talking, and I told Vern that I lost all my money. I had no job, and I had $1 million debt at around 10% interest. So just my interest a year was 100,000. And I was going to go back to Mexico to get a job. I couldn't get a job for probably 120 or 140,000, and just my interest was 100,000. So within paying taxes and interest, I was going to be in negatives. So Vern says, "Great, go back to your country, get a job, but how are you going to pay the interest?" And I was like, "I have no idea." And the guy said, "Why don't you coach on the weekends? And that way you pay your interest at least." And I was like, "Okay, I have no other options. So if it's a way for me to make money on the weekends, I'm in." And I started coaching companies on how to implement scaling up in 2009, and it was amazing. 6 months later, I was making more money on the weekend than I was making on my job Monday to Friday. So I
Wow.
resigned to my job and became a full-time coach. And after 4 years of being a coach, I paid all my debt with interest and everything. So it was very profitable for years. I was traveling 250 nights a year, but I was on the road all the time, but did very, very good financially those 4 or 5 years. And I paid all my debt. And at that moment, my second son was born. And I have a daughter of 20 and a son of 14. And I was on the road 250 nights a year. So my wife sits me down and said, "Hey, you're going to be a father or you're going to be a consultant?" I said, "I want to be a father." And he said, "Okay, great." So I said, "What can I do?" So I said, "I'm going to do what I do, but I want to do it online." So I went to Vern and said, "Hey, I'm going to do this. I'm going to resign." And he was like, "Come on, you do really well. You're one of the top three coaches in the world, blah, blah." And I was like, "Vern, I really have to do this. I need to be a father." And he said, "Okay, do this. Do Rockefeller Habits." It was called Rockefeller Habits back then, online in Spanish, "and prove to me that this works." I said, "Fine." So I did a class, launch it. I think in my launch, I did like $500,000 in my first launch. And Vern's like, "Wow, this makes a lot of sense. Let's do it out in English." And I was like, "Vern, I'm not good in English. I'm going to do it in Spanish." And the guy said, No. "I'm good in English. We're going to do it around the world. You and I are going to partner." So we built a company, Vern and I, 13 years ago, called Growth Institute. And we started with scaling up. And then we started bringing all the other methodologies that go around scaling up, like Top Grading, Great Game of Business, Marshall Goldsmith, Salim Ismail, Peter Diamandis, all the big guys that write books all about scaling companies. And we put them all together in Growth Institute. And we've been teaching CEOs today. We teach around 1,000 to 1,500 companies every year on how to really build a CEO system and drive that CEO system internally. We have like 600 hours of content online, all recorded and teach directly by thought leaders that write books. If you don't write a book that you're not top in your category, we don't record the course. And that way we build the course with the most important methodologies of business for scaling companies, target to mid-market companies on how to scale. And it's been a great ride since.
I feel like one of your core values is probably being a lifelong learner. I think that's what you've talked about in the past. Even in your company now, Growth Institute, it feels like it's an ed tech company totally focused on learning. How did that ethic come about you in life? How did you become someone who values learning all the time?
Is where I met Vern. I was an entrepreneur, very, very young, and all my friends were trying to figure out the corporate ladder. I was the only entrepreneur back then in my circle of influence. So I had no idea of other business owners. Like there was no other business owner of my age doing a technology company or a fintech or anything. And I was struggling. I was struggling big time. My first 6, 8 months, I struggled a lot. And one day I'm in my desk working like at 10 p.m. at night or something. And my head of sales is leaving the office really, really late one day and goes to my desk. I was, of course, the only one else in the office. Comes to my desk and said, "Hey, bye, I'm going to go. We're great. Thank you very much." And she said, "Hey, I see you're having trouble." And I was like, "I'm struggling big time." But I was 25, 26. I had 100 employees by then. I had no idea what I was doing. And she said, "Hey, my husband is a member of this organization called YEO, or Young Entrepreneur Organization, back then. And there's a group of entrepreneurs who probably could get some learning. You don't know any other entrepreneur. I think you're going to like it." And I was like, "Yeah, sure. Maybe an introduction." So they called me and they invited me to this group called EO. And I joined EO. I joined in 2000, 24 years ago, 25 years ago now. And it changed my life. It just completely changed my life because it gave me a group of peers like me that were entrepreneurs. And we could have conversations of entrepreneurs that I couldn't have those conversations with my other friends. And that became my life. I've been a member for 25 years. Some of my best friends are there. And most of the biggest teachings has been from EO. And when I joined EO, I said, okay, great. Who's the best person that could guide me and coach me on how to scale fast? And said, well, the founder of EO is called Vern Harnish. He has a
Yeah.
book called Mastering Rockefeller Habits. And I'm like, great, how can I meet him? And the guy said, well, there's a program in MIT called Birthing of Giants. Why don't you apply and go and take his program? And I'm like, okay. So I applied, got accepted, went to MIT. And it's a program in MIT that you go for 5 days a year for 3 years in a row called Birthing of Giants. Today it's called Entrepreneurial Master's Program. And it changed my life. It just completely, it showed me what it was to be a CEO. It gave me a community of entrepreneurs all over the world. It was game changer. Because for me, from Mexico, I just gone to universities in Mexico. I've never been to a university in the US. I landed in MIT in one of the most prestigious programs, just business owners. It was amazing. And interestingly, every time you go, they send you a box of books for you to read, but they send you the box of books 2 months before. They send it in through US mail. So US mail gets to get to Mexico like 2 months. So I got all my books like 48 hours before my flight. I've never read, I think I've read one or two business books ever in my life. And I get like six or seven books that I had to read before the first day. And I was like, guys, I have
Wow.
48 hours before the program starts. And they said, you have to read it. Because if not, you're not going to learn anything. So I called my office and said, I cannot go to work. I'm going to learn, read. And I read the 2 days before, and I read all the plane and the night before the training, because I had to read all these seven books.
Yeah.
I was blown away. I'd never really read a business book like that when I was an entrepreneur. And there were seven books that were perfect from what I was going through. So I got hooked with that. It was like, oh my God, there's people that have gone through the same issues as me and figure out how to do, and then even wrote a book that you could buy for 15 bucks. And I became a lifelong learner then. And I probably read 1,000 to 1,200 business books.
Wow.
I read around 50, 60 books a year today. Still, I read them in audiobook. I do a lot of bicycle or travel, and I mean with an audiobook all the time. And then I buy the book and go through the two or three chapters that are important to review again. But usually the first time I go through audio. But after that, I start reading all these books and figuring out all these methodologies. And I was recommending a lot of books. And people were like, oh my God, the book was amazing. What other book can I read? And I was like, why don't put it in video? And that's when we put all of this together.
Yeah, I think you had said for every issue or thing that you've encountered and experienced, there's probably a book written about it already. Someone who's already gone through that experience and you can learn from them.
100%. And that's something I learned in MIT in the first year. Every problem or opportunity I have in business, someone already went through it, wrote a methodology, and wrote a book about it. So I think Amazon today has like 3.5 million different titles of business books, just business books. So everything is written there. And today with podcasts, even more. But the problem is knowing which one is the right for you and then implementing it right. Implemented with discipline. And that's really hard. Just to give an idea, scaling up as an example. If you want to implement scaling up, there's several options. You could buy a book for 20 bucks, 24 bucks. You could take a course with Growth Institute for $1,000, $2,000. There's workshops, sometimes around probably $500, $600 for a 1 or 2 day workshop. And then a consulting that starts probably around $100,000 a year. That's it. But it's the same material. It's just the experience changes. But when I started, it was a book of $20 or a
I
consulting of
got it right
60.
here.
That's a book. So it was two options, or the book or consulting started at 60,000. Today we probably start at 100,000. That's it. There was nothing in the middle. So we said, how can we bring the experience of the book with a better experience and a better learning, but it's not 100,000. We
Sort of
could do
like
it.
bridging the gap for a lot of
That's
people.
great. And put it in a medium that people could consume it all over the world. And we have clients all over the world. It's like when I say all over the world, I think we have paid clients in 76 or 77 countries around the world. Interestingly, by the way, how to charge to a company in Iran? Impossible. There's no card from Iran that is accepted in a US merchant account.
Interesting.
We
So
like
how do
those.
you figure that out? Yeah, what did you do?
So we got, by the way, interesting. I mean, super interesting. The last podcast I did, is from a guy that lives in Canada.
Okay.
Run. So I tell the story, and the guy said, like, don't tell me the guy that bought it is and gives it a name. And I was, oh, how do you know? He's my brother. I live in Canada. My brother lives in Iran, and he's trying to be an entrepreneur, and he was struggling. And I went on vacations and gave him the scaling of book. So his brother came and
So
bought the
his
project.
brother was the one that he was trying to make the purchase. That's so funny.
We're in the podcast. He gives you his brother's name. So I go into HubSpot and I put the name of his brother, just to make, and he counts his name, his email, and when the day he purchased scaling up.
That's so
Well,
funny.
it's a small world.
But that must be exciting, working with entrepreneurs all over the world, meeting people of all different backgrounds.
Yeah, I love entrepreneurs. It's my life. It's my community. It's my peers,
Yeah.
and I've been a little bit of why we do what we do. I've been a slave of my companies for many years. I worked a lot. I've done fairly well, but I've worked 12 hours a day most of my days from 24 years. And there's been moments that I've been in trouble with my business, and my business has taken over my wallet, my checkbook, my attention, my energy, everything. So I've always said that when you build a company, you have a certain pain that you want to fix in the market. And that's my pain, that I've been a slave of my companies. My companies have taken too much from my personal life and brought a lot of drama in my
Yeah.
life. And then you build what you need. Indeed, most of the thought leaders that teach something is they write a book based on a problem they had that they had to fix for themselves. So usually you teach what you need the most. And that's what we build Growth Institute, because I need to figure out for me how to be a better CEO so I could have a life and enjoy my time. And interestingly, that started adding or bringing people like me. And that's people that I love to spend time with. When I teach in Growth Institute, I'm not teaching, I'm having a conversation with my friends.
Yeah.
And that's what I love to do. And it's really, really rewarding. Like, again, entrepreneurs all over the world. And this is what happens. We have the only course of many methodologies around the world. We're the only ones that have them in Growth Institute. So if you want to take top grading, we have the only course online. If you want to take measure organization, we have the only course online. If you want to take scaling up, we have the only course online. So someone in Iran who wants to take scaling up, we're the only company for you to take it. So it has helped us attract the best mindset or the same mindset of entrepreneurs from all over the world. And it's been an amazing experience in the process.
Yeah, it sounds like across many different disciplines and business, different, roles that you're trying to fill, it sounds like the Growth Institute encompasses a lot of that.
And for me, it's been a gift that I get to meet my heroes, the people, the books that I read that changed my life.
Yeah.
And then I go and sit down in a recording studio for 2 days with the author and build a course with them. And like, oh, couldn't get any better.
So in the past year, I'm curious, what's one book you've read that you would recommend every entrepreneur read right now?
In the last year?
Yeah, because you had said that, it's important to know what to read.
So, what have I read recently that it's important?
Yes.
Naval Ravikant, I hadn't read his book until this year. Oh my God, he's so good.
Yeah.
It's so good. The Almanac of Naval.
Almanac. Yeah. Naval is amazing.
Well, Alex Hormozi, I've learned a lot of Alex Hormozi recently.
Which one?
100 million offers and 100 million.
Oh, Alex Hormozi. Yeah.
I've learned a
Yeah.
lot of this guy recently.
Yeah.
Really, really good. I just went through The Linchpin from Russell Brunson. I did a new program at Growth Institute, and I wanted to follow a formula to selling it, like a build a funnel. And I'm mimicking and following Russell Brunson. So I've been reading a lot of Russell Brunson and Dan Kennedy recently. Let me go to my phone. That's where
Oh,
you
the,
get.
all the Audible, yeah.
Yeah, that's where I have all my juice. So I'll give
Yeah.
you the last three that I have here. I am today. I started reading Shine by Gino Wickman.
Okay.
He has one about the 10 things that you shine, not just external, but internal. Pretty good book. Building a Story Brand 2.0, really good. Building a Story Brand, I had read the first one and I'm reading the second one. And then The 5 Types of Wealth.
Oh, Sahil Bloom. Yeah.
Yes, very good, by the way. Very, very
Yeah.
good.
I just downloaded that one yesterday.
It's worth it, very worth it. In my first half of my life, it was all about me being great and making money, and you try to, it's all about you. I'm 52 today. Financially, I'm almost set, but I've done fairly well. But now my day is not about making money. It's about connections and having fun and all that. And that's where Salta Hill's book is really, really good. That's financial wealth is one of the wealths. There's other four, relationships and all that. And it helps you put perspective in your life. I wish I had read it before. Very, very good book for me. And by the way, one that I read a year, 2 years ago that has been significant for me, Die with Zero. It's a book on retirement. Very important. More in my age, as I say, I'm 52. When I was 50, I was starting to think my kids are 20 and 14. My father is 80 years old, or my parents are in their 80s. So I'm in that stage that I'm starting to think about retirement, and not it's not all about me, it's about my kids. I don't know if you read the Second Mountain from Mel Brooks.
Haven't read that one, no.
It's called Second Mountain, and your first part of your life is all about you. Your second part of your life is all about impact. It's all about helping others. It changes the perspective. I don't imagine you've heard the what they call the midlife crisis. That's what crisis is all about. Your first half, you're very selfish. It's all about you making money and you being great. And I want to speak in this conference and I want to make this money. And by age 50, you kind of figure that out. So 45, 50, that starts changing. You have kids, you're way more focused on the success of your kids. It's a different perspective. So the book, Die with Zero, was very, very helpful to have that perspective.
Yeah, I wrote that one down. I'll check it out. You had talked about earlier, and I wrote this down. You said your wife asked you, do you want to be a father or a consultant, right? And I wrote down, sounds like family is very important to you. So talk to me about that. Like, how has family consistently shown up in your life, and how has that impacted what you do?
So this year is my 25th anniversary next October.
Congratulations.
And we had our first share of hard conversations. Marriage is tough. And marriage with an entrepreneur that works 12, 14 hours a day and travels 200 nights a year, it's tougher. We've been able to maintain a good relationship and make agreements and all that. But I really believe that no success in business should overcome a failure in life. The other day, I was having a conversation precisely in MIT with the founder of Kinko's, Paul Orfelia. And the guy, so we invite him to speak. We don't pay speakers because of the level of entrepreneurs that we are. We say this is a great conclave of entrepreneurs. We don't pay for speakers, but you're going to have great conversations. And we usually pay them their plane ticket and stuff to come. And the guy said, no, I'm going to go with my plane. I said, but do you mind that I go with my wife and my kids? And I'm like, you're going to bring your wife and your kids to give a lecture? And the guy said, like, they go with me everywhere. And we're like, okay. So he came with a wife and a
That's
daughter,
awesome.
the husband of the daughter. When he teaches how he did Kinko's and how to scale and all that. And then at the end, they're asking him questions. And one of the questions was this very typical, what's success for you? And his response was amazing. He said, success for me is that when my kids grow older, they still want to have spent time with me.
Oh, I
And I
love
thought that
that.
was brilliant. And we asked him why for him. He said, your kids know everything of you. How even you treat the waiter, how you treat your spouse, if you spend time with them, like they know everything. And when they're older and they have financial independence and they still want to spend time with you, you're done.
I love that. That's incredible.
That's
What
incredible.
success for you is when your kids want to hang out with you as you get older.
So I have that. I have a couple of paragraphs of how I want my life and that written there. So every day I want to spend time with my kids, that when they're older, they want to spend time with me. So two weekends ago, I was in Washington, D.C. in business, Tuesday to Thursday. My daughter lives in North Carolina in her college. And I called her and said, hey, I'm going to be in Washington. Why don't I fly and see you? And she was like, can better I go see you? Like here's a small town. It's boring. I know everyone. Why don't we spend the weekend in Washington? I was great. So she flew to Washington Friday and we spent the weekend together. Just my
That's
daughter and me. It
amazing.
was amazing. Amazing. She's in college. She's 20 years old. And that she wants to spend the weekend with her dad. It's like,
Yeah, that's success.
you couldn't ask for more.
Yeah. We'll wrap up with this. There's a lot going on with artificial intelligence. You hear about AI. What's one thing you would tell entrepreneurs right now? You coach so many entrepreneurs, you're talking to them all the time, you're surrounded by them. That's your tribe. What would you tell entrepreneurs about AI and the effects of it on their business?
The best description I've heard from a friend, he said AI is like sex with teenagers. Talking about it, no one's doing anything there. I thought that was a brilliant quote and or a brilliant explanation. And everyone's talking about AI, but I still have very few clients that make significant business things with AI. Yeah, you sometimes put an email through ChatGPT. But then you change a process with AI or you did something significant of your business with AI, still very few. And we're getting old in AI. It's going so fast that if you don't start testing today and playing with it, no. And let me go back. One of the things that I've recently learned that I thought it was brilliant. One of the coaches that work at Growth Institute, he has two daughters, and he has this night routine, right? Brush your teeth, change, blah, blah, and then he reads them a story or something. And now he put a AI part in the routine. So every night before the kids go to bed, they have to ask ChatGPT a question. So whatever question they have in life, they ask ChatGPT. So he sits down in the next to the bed of their daughters and said, so what are they going to ask the ChatGPT today? And the daughter said, well, I was thinking about whatever. And he asked ChatGPT and they respond and have a conversation around that. But now he's training his daughters to start thinking about questions and about asking ChatGPT. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, that's amazing. I feel like in terms of sparking curiosity and taking agency, AI is incredible for that right now.
Incredible for that. So strongly recommend it. Those are the kind of things that for me, the most important is that you start getting it used to every day. So you could really feel comfortable with it and add value.
Right, integrating it into your daily life. Any final takeaways, Daniel?
Just I will challenge the people listening, the entrepreneurs, that this is a challenge I got from a mentor of mine many years ago. I said, Daniel, in sports, there are amateur teams and professional teams. And the amateur teams play, they have a lot of fun. And when the game ends, they go and have a beer or a drink and have fun. If you're a professional, when the game ends, you go and get your legs in the bucket of ice so you're ready the next day to train again. In business, same thing. You have to choose if you're going to be a professional CEO or an amateur CEO. And oh, wow, that was a tough question. But there is a way to be a professional CEO, and there's a way to be an amateur CEO. What I don't like and my conversations is you want to live as an amateur and want to have the results of a professional. So I tell my entrepreneurs, with what you're doing, don't expect you're going to go to the Olympics. No, I want to go to the Olympics. Well, with what you're doing, you're never going to get to the Olympics. So I challenge entrepreneurs to become professional CEOs.
Love that. Daniel, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Where can we find you online?
Online, DanielMarcos.scale in Instagram
Okay.
and LinkedIn, my LinkedIn, Daniel Marcos on LinkedIn. In LinkedIn, I'm at capacity. So
Okay.
you can write to me and I will have it to answer, but I cannot friends. So
Okay.
just follow. It's crazy. I got
It
like 3 years ago.
happened to me. Yeah, I tried to request you and it said the same thing.
It's a 30,000 people capacity in LinkedIn. I was mad.
Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time and hope to stay in touch.
Thank you for the invitation. My pleasure.